from KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. On air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Famuliner. Concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, are prevalent in Missouri's agriculture industry. The large farms are very controversial, and many have concerns about the environmental impact of the farms and humane treatment of animals living there. In Callaway County, plans for a new CAFO have prompted very vocal opposition, but CAFOs are also a mainstay of the agriculture industry and are legal if maintained correctly. Today on Intersection, we're going to talk about CAFOs in depth, about what they are, how they're used in Missouri, about the controversy surrounding them, and about the future of the operations in the state and the country. Joining us in studio today for that discussion is Ray Massey. Ray is a professor of agriculture and applied economics at the University of Missouri. Ray, welcome to Intersection.
Thank you.
Also in studio is Tang Lim. Tang is an assistant extension professor in the Agriculture Systems Management Department at MU. Tang, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And joining us by phone is John Laurie. John is an associate professor in the Plant Sciences Division at MU. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'd also love to hear from you in our audience as well today. There are too many sides to the discussion to have everyone at the table today, so our guests in studio will help us to explain the facts rather than debate the issue. But there is much to debate, and for that part of the conversation, we need you to, in our audience to call in and share your perspective on the issue. We'd like to hear what you think. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. Okay, so there's probably some people in our audience that aren't even sure what a CAFO is. So maybe you all could help me explain that right off the top. What is a concentrated animal feeding operation?
Well, concentrated feeding operation is nothing much but just a larger operations that confine animals to certain dates of the period of the year, and then they basically categorize them by different sizes, mainly by different numbers. For example, in this case, a class 1 CAFO, meaning that any operation that is larger than 700 heads of beef operations is considered a class 1. And in this case, it's often called a CAFO, which requires to have an operation permit with the Department of Natural Resources.
Okay. And so CAFOs are pretty common in Missouri?
I would think so.
Yeah, they're very common. Aside from beef, most of the livestock in Missouri probably would be considered a CAFO.
Mm-hmm. Okay. John, I heard you want to jump in there as well.
Well, I was just saying, in terms of most of the livestock in Missouri are confined, I'm not sure exactly. We have probably about 500 permitted operations in the state, which my guess is they probably represent nearly 50% of the animals in the state that are in confinement.
Okay. And so has that changed? When did this move to this type of farming operation really start, I guess, around the country and here?
Well, in Missouri, we've had regulations for confined animal feeding operations for over 30 years. They go back into the 70s. I mean, the regulations that were used for animal feeding operations come out of the Clean Water Act, and they're then designated in the state of Missouri. Missouri Department of Natural Resources is designated as the regulating authority, and so they've had rules in place in Missouri since the 70s. Those rules have evolved over time, but the size of operations that are regulated have remained fairly constant at that 1,000 animal units, which represents, say, 700 dairy cows or 2,500 pigs. I think it's 125,000 broiler chickens right now would be the line between regulated and not regulated.
Okay, right.
You know, John was just giving you the kind of the regulatory background, but CAFOs have also existed prior to regulation. I was raised in the high plains of Texas and New Mexico, where there were tons of feedlots. So cattle were raised until they were about 500 or 600 pounds, and they were put in a feedlot. And we didn't call them CAFOs back then. We called them feedlots. Mm-hmm. But over the years, probably beginning close to the 70s, they started putting pigs in feedlots, which were not as common back then, and then chickens. And so as hogs and chickens joined the group of feedlots, they started calling them CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations. And they developed over time. So for the most part, they're not outdoors if they're pigs and chickens. Mm-hmm. Cattle still are outdoors. But we've had them for many, many years.
Do we know why there's been a shift toward that type of operation? I mean, like, why is, what's the motivation, I guess, oftentimes?
It's basically from an engineering standpoint, if you keep things in-house, just like, well, on a hot day like this, you wouldn't feel comfortable outside all day long. And that's the exact reason we started housing animals inside the some kind of structures, whether it's just a piece of roof or whether it's actually environment control rooms. And in this case, what people found was you can better treat the animals more humanely, in a way, giving them better environment. And also, in the same time, when you treat the animals better, they tend to grow faster and better as well.
I see. Okay.
Yep.
There's also another side to it, which is, you know, from a manure management perspective, I think there was, over time, the bringing animals under confinement also led to systems where they had better control of manure nutrients. You know, that continues to be a challenge, but when you, for example, hog operations years ago, you know, we had a lot of pigs raised in creek bottoms and where they were out on the land, and that posed some issues from an environmental perspective, which are solved to some degree by confining animals. You create maybe a different set of issues, but you do control, do have the ability to control where those manure nutrients go at that point.
I see. Okay. I just want to take a moment to remind our audience this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuelner, and today on the show we're talking about concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, which are prevalent in Missouri's agriculture industry. We're talking about what they are, how they're used in Missouri, about the controversy surrounding them, and about the future of the operations in the state. Joining us in studio today for the discussion is Ray Massey, a professor of agriculture and applied economics at the University of Missouri. Tang Lim is an assistant extension professor in the Agriculture Systems Management Department at MU. And joining us by phone is John Laurie, an associate professor in the Plant Sciences Division at MU. We'd also love to hear from you and our audience as well. There are too many sides to the discussion to have everyone at the table today, so our guest in studio will help us explain the facts rather than debate the issue, but there is much to debate. And for that part of the conversation, we need you and our audience to call in to share your perspective on the issue. We'd like to hear what you think. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You can also tweet us at intersectkbia. And so, yeah, John brought up the issue of manure management. That is a big issue with these operations, right? And that's one of the things that oftentimes leads to some environmental concerns. Right?
Well, you know, I think you have a number of challenges related to manure management. And our goal with nutrient management in general with these operations is to try to develop an operation that's as efficient as possible in terms of, ideally, you'd be feeding nutrients to those animals be consuming those nutrients. You know, they're using some of those nutrients for their developing their, you know, for growing. Animals excrete probably over 80% of the nutrients that they consume. We then are collecting them, and in an ideal system, those are going directly into land application and used as fertilizer nutrients. We've seen a trend, I'd say, over the last decade to systems in Missouri that are much more efficient from a nutrient perspective. In the past, when I first came to the state, there were a lot of lagoons built, and those are notoriously inefficient in terms of retaining nutrients. In the swine industry, at least, there's much more dominance of pit systems, which are connected with land application, typically to corn and soybean rotations. That's a system that's been prevalent, let's say, in Iowa for many years. You know, that's ideally what we want to have is a system in place where the nutrients are excreted by the animal and then land applied at appropriate rates as a fertilizer for crops.
Okay. And Ray, you want to jump in there when we brought up fertilizers or manure as well, but
you know, I forgot what I was going to say. Though.
Well, I guess just generally about some of the other environmental concerns. You know, John just talked a little bit about proper management. What are some of the, I guess, the ways manure needs to be handled and the way that usually goes at some of these operations?
John really is the best one to handle how it should be handled and how it should be land applied. But I do remember now a little bit. The confined animals are more efficient than an unconfined animal, one that's exposed to the environment, the hot and the cold and things of that nature. And so when we do talk about manure management, we are talking about the amount excreted that was fed. But if the animal is more efficient, per animal there's less manure in a confined animal feeding operation than in an open operation. And so really the question is, how much manure are we going to generate? We generate less with CAFOs, but it is concentrated more. It's in a single location.
Right, so less per animal, but you may have more animals there. Right?
Have more animals in a single location. But the number of animals in the United States is dependent upon how much meat people want to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So we still need the same number of animals. It's just whether we spread them out or keep them together. Once we decide to keep them together, we can actually decrease the manure per animal but increase the manure in a particular location. And that does create some problems of making sure that that location can assimilate those nutrients in the cropland around them.
So, Ryan, I think there's a few interesting things to think about with relation to manure nutrients. One thing that people maybe are surprised to hear is probably the largest source of manure in the state of Missouri would be beef cows. But, you know, we don't worry as much about that particular source of manure because you have beef cows on pasture. They're consuming nutrients and then, you know, redepositing them back in the field. When we work with animal feeding operations, typically you have a group of animals that are concentrated in a, you know, obviously in a building. You're bringing in feed from, you know, from around the area or importing feed, for example, down in southwest Missouri where we have a lot of our poultry operations. The animals are then generating manure, and then you're depending on humans then to do a good job of redistributing those nutrients. And, you know, I think inevitably there's places and that's more effective or less effective. And, you know, really the goal of our programs is to try to help farmers understand what the value of that manure resource is and try to work with farmers to identify ways to use that most optimally as a fertilizer. One reason we're seeing better use of manure as a fertilizer is that, you know, commodity prices have gone up and fertilizer prices have gone up with them. And so the economic incentive to do a good job with manure, you know, continues to increase.
Sure. Tang, go ahead.
And because, just want to add to John's comments, is because people have been doing this in a more professional way. We actually hosted a so-called Manure Expo right here in Springfield, Missouri, just 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that particular show was to educate not just the producers, but also regulators and also all the exhibitors, including the industrial folks, how to better improve everything that has to do with manure nutrient management.
Mm-hmm.
So we're actually creating that environment for people to come in to different classroom sessions to talk about how do you maximize your nutrient values. And then we're also creating in a way that a little bit of competition for the industry. How do we improve our systems, our machineries, our technologies? And that's exactly what our teams have been seeing, because this expo has been ongoing for about a dozen years. So every year they manage to push up something that is new, that is more competitive, and trying to just bring a lot of goods to the industry. So it's been interesting.
So are you seeing a lot of producers that need that kind of help, that have kind of ventured into this territory and maybe haven't figured out quite yet what the best methods are?
Yeah, we learn so much when we, I mean, go along with the whole group, the whole team. Like, another side string of this is that we also hosted a PEDVs virus special discussion, and then I had invited a very good proactive custom applicators. He handles at least a dozens of millions of gallons of lagoon effluent every year. He pumped it for people, and then his record was zero case. And then he must have done something right. So we learned a little bit from him. So that's very good for the industry, too.
Sure. We actually have a call we were going to bring on. Laura from Nixon, Missouri, is calling in. Laura, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great. Thanks for calling in today.
Yes. I have kind of two thoughts here. I think that it's interesting that if you put all of our farmland together, it would cover about half of the United States. And in that, that is enough to feed the world. But because we eat 9 to 10 billion animals a year, we're growing about one half of our crops for factory farm animals. And that does not include the 25% wastage that we lose in these farm animals. As the population grows, so will the animal CAFO farms, and so will growing more seed for them instead of for the humans. I don't feel that this is a sustainable farming practice. But what I find what is most alarming is the fact that in this bill, in this constitutional amendment on the ballot that the people are going to see, it states citizens. But in the legal bill portion, it does not say Missouri citizen. I feel like this is very misleading. And, you know, to the Missouri people, I think this will bring in foreign CAFO farms, just like we sold 50,000 of our acres to Asian farmers at the Smithfield Farm in North Missouri. And I have one more thing. The
sure.
seed that you feed at the CAFO animals, isn't this like the Monsanto GMO seeds that you're feeding them?
We'll have to get the answer to that. Tell you what, you've given us a lot to parse out there. I may have to go through a few of those things, if that's okay.
Sure.
So if that's okay, I may let you go, and I'll kind of, cause there's a little bit of explaining on what you've just said that I'll have to put in for our listeners, if that's okay. But thank you very much for that call, because there's a lot for us to unpack. So thank you, Laura. So first off, I wanted to make sure our audience knows, Laura mentioned their constitutional amendment. That's Amendment 1 that's going to be on this August primary ballot. It's been called the Right to Farm Bill. The question on the ballot says, shall the Missouri Constitution be amended to ensure the right of Missouri citizens to engage in agricultural production and ranching practices? Shall that not be infringed? And then, as she said, it doesn't really mention that in the actual language. So that is something that has been projected out to possibly affect CAFO. So we'll probably come back to that later in the show, but I wanted to explain that very quickly, what Laura had just referenced. So her question about what feed is used, obviously none of you are actually operating CAFOs, but do you know what commonly is used in some of these operations as feed? She also referenced, you know, a lot of the crops that are produced as well being used. What's commonly used? What's recommended, I guess?
Really, what is fed to animals is probably predominantly genetically modified corn and soybeans.
Okay.
That's because the United States grows about 98% of its soybeans as genetically modified, and probably close to 75% of its corn is genetically modified. So yes, it will be genetically modified corn and soybeans.
Is there a reason for that? Why genetically modified? Is it preferred, or?
It's not necessarily preferred from the animals, because genetically modified corn and non-genetically modified corn are what they call dynamic equivalents, mm-hmm. meaning as far as science can discern, there is no difference between the two. So we know that they're created differently, they're managed differently, but as far as the amount of nutrients in them, as far as their impact on growth and other needs for the human body or for livestock bodies, they're dynamically equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're cheaper to produce, and therefore farmers produce them. They want the cheapest thing so that they can make the most profit,
mm-hmm.
and therefore they're available to livestock producers.
But nevertheless, many people like Laura likely have some concerns about the genetically modified, and that's kind of a different issue too. But
right, that's a different issue. But as far as the scientific community is concerned, they're equivalent.
John, I heard you wanting to jump in there too.
Well, I was going to say that one of the challenges that working with animal feeding operations is that, you know, there's a constellation of issues that surround these operations. You know, you have a group of people that are used that work in a certain area. You know, I work with nutrient management issues, the flow of nutrients onto the farm and the flow of nutrients from the farm onto agricultural land, and then the regulations related to that, which is the primarily, you know, water quality and nutrient regulations are the primary area that these operations are regulated. You know, in a position like mine, my goal is not to sort out necessarily some of the political issues that are out there, such as the caller was raising, but to make sure that as people make decisions, they hopefully understand the best they can the facts about how these operations operate and what their role is compared to larger or smaller operations, and also try to work with the growers themselves to try to minimize, you know, optimize their role in terms of the agricultural systems we have. So, you know, I think that I understand a lot of the concerns that are out there, some of them driven because not everybody does understand how these operations work, and there's a lot of range of quality of information out there. But, you know, at the fundamentally, on some level, I'm not sure you've got the right panel to deal with many of the questions that she raised.
Sure. Yeah, and it's tough to get to all of those today. I'm going to take a quick moment to remind our audience, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today on the show we're talking about concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, which are prevalent in Missouri's agriculture industry. We're talking about what they are, how they're used in Missouri, about the controversy surrounding them, and about the future of the operations in the state. Joining us in studio today for the discussion is Ray Massey, a professor of agricultural and applied economics at the University of Missouri. Tang Lim is an assistant extension professor in the Agricultural Systems Management Department at MU. And joining us by phone is John Lurie, an associate professor in the Plant Sciences Division at MU. We'd also love to hear from you and our audience. Do you have any questions about how CAFOs work? Ask them by giving us a call at 573-882-8925. Or email intersection at kbia.org. You can also tweet us at intersectkbia. We'd like to remind you, if you're enjoying this as a rebroadcast, that you can watch Intersection as streaming video online during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 at kbia.org. Also this Thursday, we'd like to invite you to join us for a live taping of Intersection from 7 to 8 p.m. in Leadership Auditorium at the Student Center on the MU campus. We'll be talking about doctor-patient communication in partnership with KBIA's Health and Wealth Desk, and you can join the conversation in person as part of our audience. Again, that's Thursday, July 24th from 7 to 8 p.m. in Leadership Auditorium on the MU campus. And while we won't necessarily, as John mentioned, the panel here isn't necessarily going to be able to debate everything that is brought up, we still want to hear those comments from our audience because they are part of the conversation, and the nature of any debate would be you don't always come to a resolved answer anyway. So with that in mind, we'll go to Shirley from Fulton. I've told this on the line. Shirley, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. Thank you very much for calling today.
Thank you for letting me speak.
Sure.
One of the biggest issues that my neighborhood has is with the management of the manure after it leaves the CAFO. We live about 18 miles east of Columbia, and there's a proposal to put a 7,600 sow, 2,700 geld operation, about 2,500 feet from my back door. Apparently, the proposal is to spread the manure within 75 feet of my house on a neighbor's ground. This facility is going on 20 acres of ground. That number of sows will produce over the equivalent manure of a city of 25,000 people. When you add in the over 200,000 piglets that will produce, and they get moved into new facilities to be built in the rest of the county, you're talking about manure levels of a city of over 500,000 people. Now, that seems to me should be very concerning to anyone to see that much manure spread annually on farm ground. There's no way it will use up the nutrients in that manure. Plus, no one addresses the antibiotics, the steroids, and the other contaminants that are in that manure that build up on the ground.
Okay. All right, Shirley. Well, thank you very much for that. Yeah, again, you've given us a few things to possibly parse out there. So thank you very much for sharing your thoughts and your experience there. Thank you very much for calling in today.
All right.
So I can address a couple things on that. I think the first thing is that we go through an exercise with our swine production classes, and also I do this with dairy and other animal science classes, where we start with the amount of animal that's fed an animal and then go through and calculate the number of acres of land that it would take to support a group of animals. And there is a very clear connection between the size of an operation and the number of acres needed for land application of manure. And the reality is in the state of Missouri, and most in an area like in our agricultural areas where we have row crops, typically there is access to sufficient land to support those operations. Now, it's a separate question of whether that manure actually gets appropriately distributed to those acres, and that's a fair question and something that should be looked at, obviously, with every operation, because it's inappropriate to be over applying manure on various pieces of ground.
Sure.
I don't want to paint a picture that everything works completely appropriately, because we certainly have plenty of examples of where nutrients are not appropriately applied. In terms of the 20 acres of land for an operation, within the current regulatory structure, starting at the national level and transmitting through to the state level, in our own regulations, that that's considered an export-only operation or dominantly an export of manure, they are supposed to identify farmers, a sufficient number of farmers to take their manure. You know, that is a characteristic of our current regulations that, you know, when a manure gets exported off a farm, you know, it goes outside of the regulatory sphere of that CAFO operation. So, you know, they keep records of where that manure is exported to, and that manure is supposed to be applied at agronomic rates to fields, but it does receive less scrutiny than manure that would be applied on land controlled by the animal feeding operation.
Sure. And so, yeah, you mentioned that. So then they keep records of how the producer keeps records of how that has been distributed, and then is that turned into some sort of regulatory operation? Or how is this checked, I guess? You know, like you said, things don't always go as they're supposed to. What kind of guidance or oversight is there that makes sure that things are done correctly?
Well, like I said, for a operation, for a permitted animal feeder operation that exports manure, they're expected to keep records of who they give the manure to, whether it's a contractor who's, you know, hauling it to another field, or if it's to the farmer they're selling it to directly. So it does receive much less direct scrutiny than, let's say, if they're land applying it on the fields they control. In that situation, permitted animal feeding operations are supposed to keep specific records about the rates that they apply to each field and document that they're applying it based on fertilizer need of the crop. So there is a bit of a discrepancy between how manure is handled that's exported from the farm versus manure that's applied by the animal feeding operation on land they control.
I see. Okay. Tang, yeah, definitely. I saw you wanting to jump in there, or at least nodding along, Tang, there, as John was talking.
Well, a lot of what John said probably was too much detail to a lot of our audiences here.
But helpful still. Thank you, John.
But what it is that we do have agency like DNR who is actively looking over this type of operations. And what their job is to basically to follow what comes down from our federal agency, which is EPA's. Mm-hmm. So it's not like, well, Missouri is very different from our surrounding states or many other states in the United States. So they are doing various things that are according to what EPA's are doing or suggesting. And just want to quickly point out that because of these more concentrated operations, they do have a higher chance of being inspected by agency like DNRs.
Oh, okay.
So they are under a certain kind of pressure to maintain their operations.
Okay.
And then the other thing is just last thing is that when things go bigger and more professional, we are looking at alternative ways of better utilize the manure. In this case, we are working on a couple of cases. How do we better utilize the manure? Not only just applying that, but can we look at fertilizer production from such operations?
We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back after that. Those of you on the line, we'll try to get you on after the break. Here on the studio, we have Ray Massey and Tang Lim, and John Lowry's joining us by phone. I'm Ryan from the owner. We'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famulner, and today on the show, we're talking about concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, which are prevalent in the Missouri agriculture industry. We're talking about what they are, how they're used in Missouri, and about the controversy surrounding them and the future of the operations in the state. Joining us in studio today for the discussion are Ray Massey, a professor of agricultural and applied economics at the University of Missouri. Tang Lim is an assistant extension professor in the Agriculture Systems Management Department at MU, and joining us by phone is John Laurie, an associate professor in the Plant Sciences Division at MU. We'd also love to hear from you and our audience as well. There are too many sides to the discussion to have everyone at the table today, so our guests in studio help us explain the facts rather than debate the issue, but there is much to debate, and for that part of the conversation, we need you and our audience to call in to share your perspective on the issue. We'd like to hear what you think. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at IntersectKBIA. So as we're going into the break, Tang, you were talking a little bit about some of the different entities that, you know, oversee all the different aspects of CAFOs. One thing we really haven't talked a whole lot about is air quality and the oversight there. That's been an issue that's come up many times, the emissions that are coming off there. What are some of the issues surrounding that, and what kind of regulation is there right now on air quality?
Well, when it comes to air quality, there really isn't as strict of a rule as it is in water quality. Just keep in mind that the water quality standards been evolving and has been there for the last 20, 30 years or so. Mm-hmm. And then air quality is just starting coming in fairly new in the picture. We're talking in the last maybe less than 10 years or so. So things will take some time to evolve and for people to figure out how do we better regulate this whole thing.
Well, if I understand correctly, the EPA has been looking at it for quite some time and still hasn't really told us what's going on.
No,
right?
It's not an easy thing. That's why that people have been dragging their feet. But specifically when it comes to the odor regulations within the state of Missouri, our regulation is that, well, if you get to be certain size, you need to have a so-called odor management plan for such this CAFO. And then also, regardless of your size, you need to maintain your odor to a certain level at your property line. So if you go above the threshold 1-7 ratio, then you're really meeting the threshold that you need to do something about that.
I see.
So that's a very simple term of putting it.
Oh, okay. Yep. I see. We actually have another caller I thought we'd bring on very quickly. Jennifer from Callaway County is on the line. Jennifer, are you there?
I am.
Hi, yeah, thanks for calling today.
I guess one of my big concerns, there are a few, but one that I wanted to bring up for discussion is, and Shirley touched on it a little bit, is the things that are in the waste that is generated by these CAFOs and that are then spread on, you know, fields or farms around the area where these CAFOs are. And there are things that that they have just recently written reports about. There was an article in the Journal of American Medicine just this last fall about the methicillin-resistant staph that is being carried in these wastes. You know, the PEDV virus has decimated a lot of populations of piglets in high-producing areas like North Carolina. And so I guess it's not too surprising to me that, you know, that this CAFO facility is looking to raise piglets because once the PED virus, which they can't control, they can't find anything to combat that right now, and the mortality rate is about 100% in piglets who contract that disease, it's something that gets transmitted through the air, by touch, so these farms that have been raising these animals that have had this disease decimate their population of pigs, they can't raise new litters of pigs because the contaminant is all around. So the diseases that are spread by these CAFOs is something that's very, very concerning. And this article that came out on the antibiotic resistant staph, or MRSA, that has been found to not just affect workers and swine that are being raised in these facilities, but also people within a 3-5 mile radius of any of these CAFOs, and also the farmland that the waste products are being spread on. And there's no regulation that I've been able to find in my research so far that actually tests the waste for this type of stuff, or the heavy metals that is generated by the supplements that are put into the feed that they're given.
Okay, Jennifer, thank you very much for that call and your concerns there. We'll talk about those here a little bit. Thank you very much for calling in.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody have any comments on some of the things Jennifer just mentioned? I mean, I guess first off, just antibiotics that are used. Is that common that antibiotics are going to be used? I guess that's probably pretty common in most agriculture these days.
You know it is, and right now I'm forgetting the facts. So this is somewhat opinion. We do feed low levels of antibiotics in confinement operations. Several confinement operations have begun to reduce or eliminate those low-level antibiotics just so that they can market their product. I would say that the regulations that exist with regard to what would be in the manure, whether it's antibiotics, hormones, viruses, things of that nature, for the most part, they exist in what we put into the animal rather than what's taken out, what's in the manure.
No one's going through and scooping through the manure. No.
So, you know, the regulation would be for particularly heavy metals, there's only a certain amount of heavy metals that can be fed. Therefore, there will only be a certain amount of heavy metals that are in the manure. Same thing with antibiotics. They're regulated as to how much can be administered, and therefore there's going to be a certain amount in the manure. The how that comes out, I don't have the facts right now.
Sure. But so in general, though, same thing, same question we talked about earlier, where with that type of regulation, how much oversight is there? I mean, are they actually testing animals to see what they have been fed? You know, what's practical as well, I guess, with the scale of how many of these operations we have across the country and the entities that are supposed to be overseeing them.
So I would just say on this that, you know, we heard quite a few pieces of information brought out there, you know, some of which may be true, I mean, some of which may not be true. You know, I don't work with PEDV, so I'm not going to directly counter, you know, on my knowledge of that. But I would say that there is, you know, for each of these topics, we have to understand a couple things. One is that, you know, PEDV is just one of a number of diseases that have affected the swine industry. You know, one of the reasons we moved pigs indoors, you know, 40 years ago was to solve other disease problems. And, you know, just like, you know, I think that, so this is not anything new for animal industry, whether they're inside, outside. We're always dealing with managing new challenges and new diseases and working our way through those. One thing I think is important for people to understand is we do have an issue in our society today that people really do not understand that well. They don't have direct familiarity with these agricultural systems that many of our, you know, most of our animals work with. And where there's a lack of understanding, a lack of familiarity, you know, there's, as we can hear in the phone calls, there's a fear. You know, some of those fears are, you know, sometimes justified, and some of those fears are not justified. And so the challenge is how do we convey across what for me is, you know, really a pretty large divide between the agricultural industry and the general public, what, you know, the parts of the general public that pay a lot of attention to these issues, and how do we bridge that divide? One thing I think we need to understand is that the agriculture in general changes and goes through change very rapidly. I mean, the industry, I've worked in Missouri now for about 18 years. The industry that was there when I arrived 18 years ago doesn't exist today. It's, you know, the types of feed that we feed. For example, back then, you know, it was primarily corn and beans to pigs. You know, now distiller's grains is a large component of the feed stream. So there's always new things coming in. There's also new pressures. So I think it's important for the general public to articulate what their concerns are, because that allows the industry to understand what those are. And like Ray said, to meet market goals, they will try to change how they raise pigs or how they raise cows or chickens to public pressure when, you know, because again, you know, they're trying to provide a product which consumer wants.
Sure. I guess one other group that feeds into some of this controversy that we're hearing today on the show as well, and that is prevalent outside this show as well. You know, I wonder too, another perspective we haven't talked as much is the farmers themselves, because from what I understand, some farmers, obviously ones that that run these types of operations, probably are supported, but there are also some smaller farmers that say, hey, this is making it difficult for me to compete and may have some environmental concerns too. What are the farmers that you all talk to, what are their views on this phenomenon, I guess, in agriculture?
Which phenomenon?
The fact that CAFOs are becoming more prevalent. It seems like you're saying that's something that's been more common, at least in the recent decades.
You know, like you mentioned, you can talk to two different farmers and get two different opinions.
Mm-hmm.
I know that when I left for college, my dad got rid of all the livestock on the farm because I was no longer there to feed it. And when you look at over time, most Missouri farms and really most U.S. farms have reduced or eliminated the livestock on the farms, meaning the corn and soybean and wheat farmers really want to be corn and soybean and wheat farmers. And so they're not sad to see the livestock leave. But there are some farmers who want to be corn and soybean and wheat and hogs and chickens. And at that point, they're now having to compete with a more efficient system. And rightly so, they're saying, wait a minute, these guys can sell for less than I can produce it, so that's not fair.
Mm-hmm.
The consumer would say, I want the cheapest chicken and pork I can get. I'm not interested in supporting an inefficient system, except there are many consumers now who are saying, I want local, and I'll pay more for local.
Mm-hmm.
And so the market is beginning to handle these things, but it does develop because of the market.
Interesting. We actually have another caller on the line, Cody in Norwood. Cody, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. Thanks for calling in today.
Yes, I have a question about your to give to your expert panels on CAFOs. Concerning the feed protocol that's going into these animals that are in CAFO, someone on your panel described the mix of feed mostly in soybeans and mostly in corn, which is almost all genetically modified, which is also, we know, is used a great amount of herbicide, specifically the glyphosate. And science now tells us that glyphosate, this herbicide that's used to raise this feed for these cattle all over this country, is prevalent in our drinking water, in our soils, and just recently science has told us it is in the bloodstream of unborn babies all across this country. My question that I have to your CAFO expert, what is being done in your field or your industry to reduce this amount of poisonous glyphosate entering the human body across this country as we promote more and more CAFOs?
Okay. Thank you very much for calling in, Cody. So, yeah, basically, what kind of regulation, what kind of changes when you're working with farmers to talk about the water quality, that type of thing that I think Cody was just addressing there. We've talked a little bit about the way manure is handled, right, and the way that it gets in the water systems. But I don't know. Any thoughts on that?
With the economic rate?
Right.
Actually, there are three different government agencies that are responsible for our health. One would be the USDA, one would be the Food and Drug Administration, and the other would be the Environmental Protection Agency. And all three of those have looked at glyphosate and said that it is safe. So when somebody says the science has said it's not safe, either we have a problem with our government or the science says it is safe, because mm-hmm. the government scientists are saying it is safe, at least from the EPA, USDA, and FDA.
Right. So again, when you're talking about enforcing rules, if there's no rule saying this is a problem, then...
Actually, yeah. When you bring on a genetically modified organism, it goes through extremely rigorous testing before it's ever released into the public, which is, there have been times when it was released before it was fully tested. Starlink would be an example of that. Mm-hmm. Caused millions of dollars in losses for the company that inadvertently released it inappropriately. So companies don't want to release it before it's gone through the FDA, USDA, and EPA.
Hey, take a moment to remind our listeners, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Fumulner, and today on the show, we're talking about concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, which are prevalent in Missouri's agriculture industry. We're talking about what they are, how they're used in Missouri, about the controversy surrounding them, and about the future of the operations in the state. Joining us in studio today for the discussion is Ray Massey, a professor of agriculture and applied economics at the University of Missouri. Tang Lim is an assistant extension professor in the Agricultural Systems Management Department at MU, and joining us by phone is John Laurie, an associate professor in the Plant Sciences Division at MU. We'd also love to hear from you and our audience as well. There are too many sides to this discussion to have everyone at the table today, so our guests in studio will help us explain the facts surrounding the issue rather than debate it. But there is much to debate, and for that part of the conversation, we need you and our audience to call in to share your perspective on the issue. We'd like to hear what you think. Give us a call by 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You can also tweet us at intersectkbia. So another thing that we've kind of been talking about as we've gone through the show is that if things are done the correct way, there are rules that guide all these different issues we've been talking about today. How much of a problem, though, is that producer who's not doing things the right way? Is that something that may feed some of the controversy? I guess the fact that sometimes there are some of these bad examples, since there are so many that have. What are some of the issues that we see arise with that? I guess too.
Well, from a nutrient management perspective, we certainly have examples of issues. One of the key issues that we see with animal manure is that it's not a balanced fertilizer. Most sources of manure provide a lot more phosphorus compared to nitrogen. And so if a farmer is applying manure based purely on the nitrogen content of the manure, they'll see their soil test phosphorus levels raise up. And when that happens, phosphorus is one of the nutrients that's limiting in most of our freshwater systems. And so we see runoff of the water that leaves that land will have a higher phosphorus content and leads directly to degradation of water quality. One of our goals has been to help farmers understand that balance of nutrients and try to rotate land that gets manure. So we're not only addressing the nitrogen content of manure, but also the phosphorus content of manure.
Interesting. Okay. Are there any other examples of that where someone may just not know the right way to do things to minimize harm, I guess?
Well, some of it was just because of accidents in your daily operations should something went wrong. I mean, if there is a manure spill, yes, just because of your share sizes of it, a little bit of your spill could mean a lot, and it could easily cause fish kill. Mm-hmm. So those are to some of the extents. But there are also, and I think that a lot of our farmers nowadays have gotten enough training and have gotten to be very well with what they do. They know when not to spread manure, like on the during a long weekend that is coming up, and then you know the wind is blowing to your neighbors, you better not doing that and spreading during that long weekend. Mm-hmm. So things like that, I think a lot of it people have already caught those. So it's just some examples that, you need to pay attention to what you're doing.
Sure. Yeah. John?
I would just say I do think there is always opportunity for us to improve our operations. I mean, I think that there is, I think we've made progress over the years, and some of that progress, economically based progress, because of the increased value of the manure, so farmers do a better job with it. But I think there's opportunity to develop new standards from an efficiency perspective, and a lot of our regulations are focused on large versus small, but when it comes to nutrients, should be evaluating our operations on how efficiently we put together that chain of feeding the animals and then reusing the manure as a nutrient on operations. And some working with those concepts to help farmers understand the difference between their operation and their operation.
Sure. And so one of our callers earlier mentioned Amendment 1. I know we're not poli-sci people here at the table necessarily, but there have been a lot of things in the recent past in Missouri that have maybe affected a little bit the prevalence of these CAFOs, right? There was a big lawsuit in 2010, Premium Standard Farms, $11 million to residents around because of complaints about environmental impacts. And then the next year, though, there was the legislature passed a law protecting these producers from this liability suits. On the opposite side, Scotland County was just ordered to pay $180,000 to a farmer who's permit they denied in 2011, right? So there's, on both sides, we've got some of this intervention from the state and from courts. What are, how do we have any idea of how that all has affected how these CAFOs come and go in the state, and whether this Amendment 1 may also be something that, that affects how many of these we see in the state?
You know, from an economic perspective or from a property rights perspective, what we have is we have a new technology or an evolving technology which has people that want it and some people that don't. So you've got two farmers right next to each other, and one decides to build an animal feeding operation on his land. 100 years ago or 50 years ago, he would have built one that was small. It would have still stunk. But the other guy already had animals on his land, and so they stunk. Mm-hmm. And they both stunk. But when the one got rid of his animals, he wanted to get rid of the stink. And so now he says it's a violation of you, or a violation of my rights to have your stink coming on my land.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it could be looked at the other way. The guy who got rid of his animals and no longer has the smell is now imposing on the rights of the one who continues to have animals. So it's a rights issue.
Mm-hmm.
Amendment 1 begins to defend or define who has what rights.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't studied it enough to know if it's clear.
I think people who have studied it still aren't sure if it's clear.
But what will be done is over time, rights will be established, who has what rights, mm-hmm. and that will be very easy then for the courts to decide. The problem will be is that we'll continue to evolve in our production and new questions will arise as to what's a right.
Sure. And just, to, Tang, go ahead.
So the perspective of order complaint is very, very subjective to people. One, people may feel very strongly about this particular operations because of history, different backgrounds, all kinds of stuff. And it's, I have to admit, it's not easy.
Mm-hmm.
But there are certain tools that we can use nowadays to better predict your footprint. If you have such and such operations, you know what kind of characteristic that you have. We can much better predict what they are now than what we were 10 years back.
Sure, sure. And just to be clear, that Amendment 1, I'll read it again. I read it in the first half, that the question on the ballot says, shall the Missouri Constitution be amended to ensure that the right of Missouri citizens to engage in agriculture production and ranching practices shall not be infringed? So it's very vague, right? It doesn't address, it doesn't mention CAFOs anywhere. It doesn't mention, you know, GMOs. It doesn't mention anything like that. It's just kind of this blanket passage. North Dakota has passed something like this a couple years ago, and there have been no lawsuits to figure out what exactly it means quite yet. So just on the background on that for audience, I wasn't aware of that. But I did want to bring in quickly another caller. We have Susan from Ozark on the line. Susan, are you there?
Yes, uh-huh.
Great. Thank you very much for calling in today.
Yes. I was on the Internet and noticed that Scotland County lost an appeals case mm-hmm. in the amount of $180,000 against a Galvin Hank for denying him a permit for a CAFO farm in 2011. And my concern is that these animals in these farms, they actually belong to corporations and not to independent farmers. They belong to like George's or Tyson Foods and things like that. And I'm concerned that corporations and our government-owned food plants will sue and take over the independent farmer by providing cheap and unhealthy meats. And once you control these farmers, you control the food and you control the people. Now, there's no science behind that, but the corporations suing for permits, and these corporations have very powerful, wealthy lawyers behind them, but them suing for permits and these powerful lawyers on their staff. To me, CAFOs are going down that road. And you mentioned about the Amendment 1. You need to look in the law of the bill. You mentioned citizens, but look in the bill that will go in effect when it is passed. There is no mention of the word citizens, and that's what concerns me, which I think is wrong. But I even know for a fact that the teaching in our colleges today are backed by Farm Bureau and Monsanto money. So when you receive money from these corporations, you're going to teach their way. And by MSU receiving money from Farm Bureau and Monsanto, of course, they're going to be teaching what it is that they want them to teach. So I think,
I'm sorry, I didn't say anything.
Oh, there seems to be background. Somebody in the background of somebody who is here, you can hear a man and people talking in the back. But
oh, sorry.
I think a lack of understanding is not the issue with us consumers. It's who is driving the industry. And most of us recognize, since we cannot get GMO labeling, never have been able to, that is Monsanto and them driving the industry. And that is a concern for consumers, that if we don't have the choice of foods, I do know that Monsanto seed is laced with a Roundup product, a poison that is, of course, fed to the animals, and then the humans ingest them. And yeah. No, I don't particularly like that. And as far as this being a new industry, the factory farming industry has been around since 1914. This is not a new industry.
Susan, I'm going to have to interrupt you just because we've only got a couple minutes left on the show, and I want to give our guests a chance to respond to what you said. But thank you very much for your call. I really appreciate it. So I guess, yeah, just in general, any response you have to that? I mean, she talked a lot about the fact that corporations are being involved very heavily now in farming. We talked a little bit about big ag versus the small farmer now. But
yeah, I would just say that the market does exist for people to buy local, to buy organic, and you probably should assume that if it does not say organic, it will have genetically modified corn or soybeans in it. That's just what we produce in the United States. So if it does not say organic, it will have GMOs in it.
Mm-hmm. And is what she's saying true, though, that there are many corporations now involved in some of these large farming operations, more than in the past, that the corporations are kind of seeing this as a way to make a lot of money?
Corporations are a business entity that helps people make money. Mm-hmm. It also helps them go out of business. I mean, we've seen Premium Standard Farms go out of business. It was a corporation. So they both start businesses and go out of business.
Sure. We just have a few moments left in the show, and so I think we're going to have to just go ahead and wrap it up.
Okay.
So thank you very much for all of our callers today for fostering this conversation today. That's it for today's Intersection. Thanks to our guests, Ray Massey, a professor of agricultural and applied economics at the University of Missouri, Tang Lim, an assistant extension professor in the Agricultural Systems Management Department at MU, and John Lurie, an associate professor in the Plant Sciences Division at MU, who joined us by phone. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and take part in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. We'd also like to remind you to join us for a live version of Intersection today from 7 to 8 p.m., from 7 to 8 p.m. in Leadership Auditorium at the Student Center on the MU campus. There we'll be discussing doctor-patient communication in partnership with KBIA's Health and Wealth Desk. Again, that's this Thursday from 7 to 8 p.m. in Leadership Auditorium on the MU campus. Intersection broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. It's produced by Janet Saidi and Maureen Lewis-Stump. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Lowell Thomas. Austin Federa is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. And I'm Ryan Famuliner. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.